an addict. My name is Beverly. Welcome to the Newlyweds. Steve and Sophie just arrived. Congratulations. Our blessings. I've been asked several times if I'm nervous. And you would think with some of the physical symptoms I am having that I am. But in fact, I'm not. What I have is adrenaline rushing through me, and my heart is pounding, my hands are sweaty, my brain is totally empty, but my heart is full. And I'm not nervous because I asked God into my life a long time ago. And through practicing the principles of this program for long enough now, I live on a regular basis with a higher power in my heart and with a conscious contact. Now, when my heart stops beating, my voice will calm down and all will be well. I think I've been given the opportunity to talk on one of the most personal aspects of this program, and that's our personal contact with a higher power. So let me start off by saying that anything that I have to say is really my own. Any experience that I share is my own. And it may not work for you, and it may not fit for you, and if it doesn't, that's okay. If it does, if it helps you believe in yourself a little bit more, what you've been feeling, what you've been going through, if it challenges what you've been thinking, great. But it is only my experience. And that is the beauty of this program, is that we're allowed to develop conscious contact that is really personal. This program is a spiritual program, and often we don't hear it enough. So what I'd like to do is kind of go through the steps and share with you my vision of how they are spiritual and how they work in my life. Oh, I'll just add one more thing, and I don't want to, you know, open any controversy, but I don't believe in the gender-specific language of our steps, and I hope one day that will be reflected in the changes that we might make. And I don't choose to use the word God in my own life, in my own personal beliefs, but I do use it in respect of the fellowship and communicating what it is that I'm talking about. I've had many names for my higher power. And just to facilitate getting across my message, I'll say the word God to you today. The first step for me was not difficult to admit that I was powerless over my addiction. It was difficult to break that down and say I was powerless over drugs, because I didn't go to the ends of an addiction that said and that proved to me that I couldn't keep using. What did happen was that I was given an opportunity to awaken spiritually at a time in my life when I was ready for it. I had used for, I'm not good at math, probably 13 to 15 years. And my life completely fell apart because of drugs. Not just my own using, but at that time my partner. Our whole life had become centered on drugs, in the getting and using and finding ways to means and get to get more. Everything that I did in my day, okay, had become influenced by my use of drugs. Every decision that I made with my life had become influenced by the use of drugs. I had done some pretty drastic, crazy things with my life, all because of the influence of drugs. And when given the opportunity to take a look at that, I was ready to admit that I did not want to live a life with drugs anymore. Understanding the unmanageability in my life was a lot harder. I was brought up, as a lot of women are, and I don't speak for all of women, but a lot of women have been brought up to keep things looking good, keeping the house tidy, the books and the records straight. And I was brought up like that. And everything about me looked good. At that time, I had, you know, I was an up-and-coming preppy. We had everything we could have wanted. I traveled a lot. I wasn't working. I had two children, two cars. We had our own company. And we had an addiction that was killing us both. And how I recognized that it was killing me was emotionally and spiritually. Not necessarily physically, but emotionally and spiritually. I was dead at the time that I was introduced to the idea that there was an addiction or that there was the idea of addiction. I'd never really thought about it before. When family members suggested I had a problem with drugs, I shoo-shooed them away to the point that when I was ready to take a look, there was no one left in my life but me and my using partner and two children. I think the fact that I had children, not only did it interrupt my using, and I know that that is true, but it also gave me reason to take a look or to be open enough to see that drugs had influenced my life to such a degree that I was not where I wanted to be. So once done, I took a look at the second step. And in the second step, I want to find the steps here so they're right there for me. Once done, I looked at the idea of coming to believe in a power greater than myself. Now, I had always believed in something spiritual, but I didn't know what that was. I had always been looking for some spiritual answers, but I had never received the answers that I needed. And I had looked long and hard and in the same places that many of you looked. What I'd like to share about the second step is that it forced me ultimately, not initially, but ultimately, to look at the conditioning that I had adopted over my lifetime, not just during my using, but during my whole lifetime. Somewhere along the way, I had picked up certain messages, and I had come to believe in those messages. By repetition, by seeing them at work, in my life and in the life of other people, and I had to start to look at what I had been giving power to in my life. There were a lot of things that I gave power to. I gave power to my gender. You know, I thought women had certain things that they could use, certain things that they could do that gave them power in the world. I looked at my family name, which wielded a certain amount of power within our circle. I looked at money. I looked at property and prestige. And all of those things I had given power over to. At some point, I had given power over to drugs. I used them to party. I used them to cry. I used them for every aspect of feelings that I could have. And I didn't know that I was squashing most of my feelings. I didn't know that. I was using them to express myself. I was using them to be creative, to go to that other side where I could hallucinate and see munchkins walking down the road and I knew I'd arrived, that kind of thing. When I started looking at what I had been giving power to in my life and I looked at the course of my journey, that the things that I'd been giving power to hadn't gotten me where I wanted to be, because I certainly did not imagine that this young woman was going to end up where she did. So I looked at that. I looked at the things that I still was believing in to the best of my ability. I was pretty raw for my addiction. And I was pretty lost in understanding recovery. So I was right in that middle place that we come in on, really believing. For some reason, I saw in these 12 steps hope. And I saw the possibility of a change in my life. But I still didn't know the how to get there. I saw it written, but I didn't know the how. So I was lost in that middle space. I don't know how long I stayed lost there, but it's more than just a couple of months of recovery. It was quite a long time. It took a long time to uncover the things in my life I was giving power over to. Once I got clean and I stopped giving power over to the drugs, some of the other things that I gave power over to started coming up in my life, and I needed that to happen so that I could see it. Now, the second part of the second step, when it talks about our lives being insane, because if we're asking to be restored to sanity, we have to assume at some point we were insane, I had real trouble with, because I was not insane to my way of thinking. And that's because one of the things I had come to believe was that the definition for insanity was a mental illness. I didn't realize at that time, as I feel like I believe today, that the definition for me of insanity is not knowing right from wrong. And when I look at my own life, I realize that everything that I did that today I can look back on is wrong at the time I believed was right, or I found a way to believe it was right. So that when I stole things, from major stores, I would buy one and steal one and figure that was fair. I had a way to rationalize the things that I was doing. Those rationalizations lasted for a long time and kept me safe from the truth that I was not living according to my own truth. In fact, I was going so far from my own truth that I was cutting myself off from myself. Once I realized that, it was easy for me to see that I did need to be restored from sanity. But step two didn't give me any answers. It just helped me see that I had come to believe in a lot of things that weren't working, and I had become insane because of those things. So then the essence of the second step was revealed to me, that now I can choose what am I going to give my power to. So I sat down and I made a list. I brainstormed. What was God going to be to me? What attributes did I want in a God? It was like a relationship shopping list, you know? What did I need from this God? And what was I going to expect? I was really creative at that moment. But I just want to remind everybody, because it's taken me a long time and I don't think I'm unique, that the process of coming to believe means that it takes time. In the first and second step, and how long that took me to work those two steps, I had many, many spiritual experiences that helped me, that pushed me along the road, that convinced me that I could keep going, that something was really there for me. I thought those were spiritual awakenings, but in fact today I look back and see that they were spiritual experiences that were going to help move me from a belief. Because I made a decision, I'm going to come to believe. This program says come to believe, I'm going to come to believe in a higher power. Now, when you come to believe, that doesn't mean you have faith, as far as I see it. When I came to believe, it was blind faith initially. I felt something in the group. I said, okay, this group, I can feel it. Something I can't touch, I can feel, is working here. I'm going to believe in that feeling. That was the beginning of starting to trust myself again, because I had lost all trust in myself. Not consciously. I couldn't have told you that consciously then. But now I look back, I know I had lost all trust in my sense of how to live life. You know, it's like sitting on a chair. I don't know when I came to believe that a chair would actually hold my weight. Sometimes I still don't. But anyway, there was a time in my childhood growing up that I sat on a chair enough times that I knew I could sit on a chair without worrying. That's for me what it's like to come to believe in a higher power. I have to have enough experiences putting it into practice to really believe and have a faith that a higher power is in my life on a daily basis. So I don't think the second step is when I understood that there was a higher power in my life on a daily basis. That was my opening, my chance at discovering a higher power in my life. Okay, so then we move to the third step. And it says we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of that God. Well, I couldn't do that initially. Initially, how I practiced the third step was the same way as I did all my life. I problem solved with God. If I had a problem, I'd work it, I'd think of solutions, I'd find more solutions, I'd ask you your solutions, I'd try on all the solutions, and when none of them worked, I'd throw up my hands and I'd go, okay, God, take it away. If you're there, take it away. And I would just really get out of the problem. It's not that I truly believed that that problem would be solved, but with my back against the wall, what else was I going to do? I didn't want to work it anymore, so I'd turn it over. So I thought. I see today that that was what I was able to do at the time, and I needed to come to see that. I needed to do that part of the step before, many years later, I would see it differently. So I problem-solved with God a lot. It became a little different than it had been in my using years, when I would say, please, God, don't let this happen. And then when the crisis was passed, never think of God again until the next crisis. It became much more conscious than that, much more daily than that. But I still was problem-solving with God. I was really asking God to be a little servant of mine. you know? And I heard it shared in the rooms that that's what we do. When you get a problem and you've tried everything, you've taken all the action you can, then you can turn it over. I see it differently today. I see that when I problem solve with God, then what I really need to do is go back to my second step and recognize that all I've asked God to do is my will. Get me out of situations. Answer my questions. Give me the things that I want and I think I need. Or take care of things that I can't take care of, which is not at all turning my will and my life over to the care of God. It's turning the parts that I can't deal with over to the care of God. So the third step is one that I come back to often. And it's the first time in our program, in our 12-step program, where we have a conscious contact. It says, you know, you have a conscious contact because if you are going to ask something to be there for you, to take something away from you, you've got a conscious contact. Like if I walk up to you and ask you, can you deal with this for me, that's a contact I have with a human being. So when I'm asking God to do something, that's a conscious contact. So for the first time, I have conscious contact with my higher power. Fourth step, my first fourth step, what I could do with it took well over 6 months. And I wish someone had have guided me then to understand what I understand today, that it's called a fearless inventory. What I was able to do was a very fearful recounting of all the bads that I had done, all the experiences that I had had. And I thought that was my fourth step. But that's not what the fourth step asked of me at all. It didn't say give a history. An inventory is not a history. An inventory is a stock of what I have now. It's what do I have in store now. It's not what did I have then or what will I have. It's what do I have today. Well, honestly, I couldn't have done that because I was so lost and misunderstood so much about feelings and characteristics and my own morality that I couldn't have told you what I had. So I did the best I could and I gave a history of all my wrongs. I know you said list your good points, but I didn't want to be too egotistical and I didn't see many good points. And any good point I did see, I would have a yeah, but there was this on the other side that sort of canceled it out. I didn't realize that in an inventory taking, what you have and what you don't have don't cancel each other out. It just is an observation of what's there. So today when I look at a fourth step, I realize that if I'm, you know, struggling and it's taking months and moons and I'm talking about it and bitching about it in meetings, that I'm not at all doing a fearless inventory. And what I really need to do is go back and look at my third step. Because if all I'm doing is observing myself, taking stock of myself, and I'm asked to do that with fearlessness, then there is no place for guilt. There is no place for shame. And there is no place for the resentful, all the other negative stuff that was coming out in my first couple of inventories. I realized today that if I had actually turned my will over to the care of God and the deep sense that I feel I know today, there wouldn't have been a struggle at all. But I had to go through the struggle to come to know that. I was in the right place. I had all the tools that I could use at that time, and I coped as best as I could. What is my will? I've struggled with this. I know I have sat in rooms asking question after question, checking out with you if it was all right if I did this thing. I thought that I could find out God's will in every thought and action that I took. And I struggled and beat myself up and beat you up and let you beat me up and all of that stuff to figure out God's will. Today, in a bigger picture, it's come to me so simply, I can't believe it escaped me for so long. And I believe today God has one will for me, and that's for my well-being. That's all. I don't believe and never have in a God that's sitting at some computer terminal sending me tests and trials and tribulations. I think life is full of those things. And what God sends me is courage, serenity, things like that to know how to deal with it. But at the time, I did sometimes still believe in a God of tests. God won't send me anything I can't handle. Well, that implies that God is sending disaster and sending dilemma at his free whim. Well, I had to struggle through all those beliefs and the blocks to my truly having faith in what I really believed in. So once you get past the inventory and you get to a place where you can do an inventory that is truly fearless and God-inspired, it's quite easy to sit down and to take a look, because all you're doing is observing yourself with the eyes of God in mind, that there is no good and bad, that you are just taking stock, which is already an act of conscious contact. In the fifth step, when we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, that's the next time we have a conscious contact. Because we admit to God. And when you admit to anyone, you're having a contact. So we admit to God the exact nature of our wrongs. Again, this was a clue that escaped me for a long time. The nature of our wrongs. It didn't say the bad things I'd done. It didn't say to list everyone I stole from. Or every time I'd ripped somebody off. Or every time I'd stepped on someone's shoes to get ahead. It said the nature of my wrongs. What was going on behind the actions? What was my intention? Why was I doing those things? I didn't know. So I stayed giving history for the first couple of years. As it has been shown to me today, the exact nature of my wrongs are things like insecurity, make another person feel bad so I don't have to look at myself, push it outside, blame, so I don't take responsibility. If I can get something outside of myself, I'm not looking here. You know what I'm saying? Share it with another human being for a long time. My sharing with another human being was full of my own ego. Because I could tell you that I shoplifted, right? Because I know most of you have stolen something at some time. So you're not going to judge me too harshly. But if I had a secret that I thought someone didn't have, I couldn't tell you. As a matter of fact, even my stealing I didn't talk about for about 3 years into recovery because I was too ashamed. That's how fearful I was of exposing myself, of becoming vulnerable with the things that I'd done and who I'd become. So often I would go to people who I knew would accept me, knew would give me the answers that I wanted. And I'm not saying run out to someone who's going to judge you. I mean, that's the complete opposite and it doesn't do any good. But I'm saying take a risk to share all of me with someone. Because I used to compartmentalize my sharing, not intentionally, but when I look back, I can see that that's what was happening. You know, with a certain person, I would act this way. With another person, it would be this way. There was no integrated spirit here. I was broken off into so many pieces. I needed that experience to know what it felt like to be integrated. So I'm not looking back with any, you know, sadness that those years passed and that's what I did. I'm just looking at it saying, that is what happened to me. That's what I'm here. I'm sharing my experience. The sixth step, some call an action step, and I don't. I don't think the sixth step is an action step. I think it's a state of being step. It suggests that we become entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And I don't think that there's any action to be taken there. I think it's a question of coming to know yourself, coming to know the nature of your wrongs, coming to God and saying, I am getting ready. Now, I don't know about you, but when I got here, I thought life without drugs was going to be partyless. It was going to be hell on earth. Because I didn't know how to live and have any kind of fun, let alone deal with any pain, without the use of drugs. So I thought it was going to be weird to be here. You proved me wrong. But I must say that at some level of my consciousness, I thought God was going to change me completely. That Beverly would be unrecognizable to herself. And I was scared. So I held on to certain methods of being myself that while I had even identified they'd become ineffective, I couldn't let go of them. I wasn't entirely ready because I didn't entirely believe God wanted my complete well-being. What would it mean? We talk about we're not saints. It would mean I wouldn't be able to have sex. I wouldn't be able to party hard. I wouldn't be able to gather material things because to be humble, one had to be poor. I wouldn't have things. You know, there was so much I thought I would have to give up if God took over the care of my life. I didn't know those things. I couldn't speak those things at that time. Today, in looking back, I know those are the things that held me back. I remember a sponsor that I had back then said something to me like, what do you think? You're going to come in an extrovert and all of a sudden become an introvert? That's not going to happen. And that statement stayed with me over all of these years, and I realized, do you know that if God leaves me with certain of my attributes that at one time I thought were defects, maybe they're not defects at all? Maybe I had identified them as defects? Or maybe I'd identified them as attributes. I shared recently and said something about my patience. I've always been told how patient I am, got a lot of strokes for it, so I became even more patient. And I'll tell you today, patience is in my list of weaknesses, because sometimes I'm too patient. I put up with too much sometimes. So the same thing that can be a strength can also be a weakness. And I realized that God was going to leave me with exactly what God thought I needed. Not with what I thought needed removing or what I thought I needed to be left with. And that again was a really good test of my third step. Because I still wanted the control. I still wanted to tell God what to leave me with and what to take away. Again, I was reminded, go back to your second and third step and look at the higher power you have chosen to turn your life over to. Oh, can I just jump back for a second to the third step? Because something that I hear often, actually it's in the second step, and I don't know where anybody gets this, but it says, some people say, well, turn my life over to the care of a light bulb or to a tree or something like that. And I go, okay, well, where are we hearing this? We're passing it around amongst each other, but nowhere does it say that in our text. Nowhere does it say it in the step. The step clearly states what it needs to be. It needs to be a power greater than yourself that can restore sanity. Well, light bulbs don't restore sanity. And trees don't restore sanity. They bring peace, but peace is insanity. These rooms have helped restore my sanity, but ultimately it's been a higher power greater than myself and yourself that has really cleared up my insanity. Just wanted to go back to that. I wanted to bring that up again because we have no business turning our will and our life over to the care of something that's inanimate and can't do the job. In our text, it describes a loving, caring, spiritual power. That's all. So just, if you hear this light bulb thing, so we come to step 7. Now there's an action step. But it's not an action step in the way that I always thought it was an action step. Here we go again. Another test of my third step. I ask God to remove my shortcomings. And then what do? I set about deciding what I need to do. I can't act impatiently. I can't act angry. I can't act this way. If I need, you know, if I'm impatient, I need to practice patience. And while that is true, I've lost my seventh step if that's all I'm doing. Because I've asked God to remove my defects and asked God for help with my shortcomings. I haven't said I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of me to do it. And in this step, I used to get confused that I had to take all the actions. And I forgot that I'd asked for a miracle, for a spiritual power to do for me what I really couldn't do for myself. Have you seen angry people try to not act angry? They get sick. We need to understand what's behind the anger, the exact nature of whatever it is. And that way we have become ready so that God can do the work that we can't do. Again, we have conscious contact in the seventh step because we're asking for something from God. the eighth step is the first step that says that we have homework. We have to write down those that we have harmed. It says to do so without prejudice. Again, it's like that inventory. It says just do an inventory, which is taking stock. It's not, yeah, but these are to me. If we look at the eighth step and we're still saying, yeah, but what did you do to me? And we argue that way, and we do our eighth step that way, then you really haven't gotten past the second step. Because when you ask for a loving higher power to come into your life to restore you to sanity, blame, responsibility is gone. It's about, we're in a 50-50 relationship here, this God and me. It's not about blaming myself, blaming God, blaming you. It's about doing what I can, taking the actions that I can. It's about looking at my behavior. So when I make a list of all the persons I had harmed, that was really difficult in the first couple of years because I was really still very caught up in what they'd done to me. As a matter of fact, I spent a lot of my time when I was with my family demanding that they take responsibility and be held accountable for what they'd done to me. I hadn't done this to myself. Now, I agree with that today, but I don't behave the same way with them. I agree that my family helped me become who I am today. Well, you know what? This was told to me in my first 6 months of recovery, that if I was going to try to work this program, I was going to become a little bit super different than the rest of the world. And I didn't quite understand that then. I elevated myself to I'm better than, you know. And sometimes we do this in these rooms. The them out there, they're not as good. They don't have a program naturally worked on.
But what I came to realize was that society had done to my family, and it had carried on from generation after generation. Now, who was I going to hold accountable?
This society is not all that well with its own spiritual principles. You know, we say, oh, the Ten Commandments, we should live by those Ten Commandments. We shall kill no one. And yet we have wars to help countries out. We kill people because we're helpers, you know, things like that. We're not completely in alignment with our spiritual principles in this world. So I think it's pretty natural that I should not be completely in alignment with my own spiritual principles that even still today I'm coming to develop. It helped me stop blaming my parents for the nasty deeds they had done. Because truth be told, I look back and I know, and you used to say this, you used to say they did the best they could, and I went, and I used to listen to your stories of forgiving your parents, and that I beat myself up with. I shared about this just recently. I beat myself up with other people's success stories of reuniting with their parents and having these blossoming relationships, and I never could get there. And 6 weeks ago today, my father passed away.
For the conclusion of this presentation, please turn your cassette over and depress the play button. Do not rewind your cassette.